I have a message from another time. A Reproductions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Fourth Movement, Duelist of the Rose, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that's me. With Chris Overstreet. Friday, January 7th, 2405. Worcester Preparatory Institute, Earth. The Honorable J. Maurice McEachern, universally known as Moose, leaned his considerable bulk back into the depths of Wedge Bench Number 1 and sighed. The first day back from a school holiday was always an interesting combination of hectic activity and dull lassitude. In this case, more of the latter, because he didn't have much of anybody to talk to. No one else in the Institute Band Geeks Federation had returned to the Institute yet. Azalin hadn't gone away for the holidays, but she was nowhere to be found. Normally, Moose would have killed time the first day back by sitting around jawing about the break with his roommate, Davy Crockett, but Davy wasn't around either. That was odd, even a bit unsettling. Davy was Tenctonese, assiduous and punctual in all things. For him not to show up the first day dorms opened was so out of character, it made even laid-back Moose a little nervous. In fact, there were quite a few familiar faces not around, as he sat and people-watched. The more he watched, the more it weighed on his mind, as if to counterbalance the delicious lightness of his body after a Christmas vacation spent in the 3.2 standard Gs of Hoffman. Something weird was going on. He could feel it. As he sat and pondered this, he noticed the short, slightly rounded, very slightly, from Moose's Hoffmanite perspective, form of Miss Claudia Montaigne, the Dean of Student Life, crossing the wedge. He gave her closer attention. She looked worried, her bun of strawberry blonde hair slightly disordered, and she had a rather crumpled piece of paper in her hand. She made straight for Moose. "Morning, Miss Montaigne," he rumbled, sitting up straighter and getting his feet off the booth's center platform, too low to call it a table, really, in his opinion. Such deference wasn't really required. Miss Montaigne was not one to stand on ceremony. But that very fact made Moose respect her more than he did many of the so-called administrators he'd met in his lifetime so far. "Good morning, Maurice," she said, sounding as harried as she looked. "I'm sorry to be so brief, but I have a lot of these to do, and I want to do them all personally." She paused, patting in her hair as though trying to organize her thoughts along with it. "Have a seat," said Moose affably. "You look like you could use a rest, however busy you are. Can I get you something to drink?" he asked, gesturing toward the snack bar off to the right.
"No, thank you, Maurice," said Miss Montaigne, but she did sit and looked a little more at ease. Moose had that effect on people, especially women. No one, Moose certainly included, really understood why. "I'm afraid I have some bad news."
Moose blinked at her. Bad news? When Claudia Montaigne had bad news, it could mean anything from "you're on academic probation" to "your mother just died." That was one of the bad parts of her tough job here. "Yes?" he asked, since she seemed to be expecting him to.
"Your roommate, David Crockett."
"Something's happened to Davy?" said Moose, his dinner plate hands going flat on the table.
"No, he's well," Miss Montaigne assured him, "but he's withdrawn from the Institute. He won't be returning for the spring terms."
"Withdrawn? What for? Some problem in his family? Money trouble? It couldn't be the course load. Davy was one of the best students I know."
"No," said Miss Montaigne sadly. "It wasn't his choice. The Tenctonese government has recalled all their citizens from Earth."
"All?" Moose blurted. "There's a 250,000 of them in L.A.
"Most of those are still here. They're Earth citizens, remember, going back generations now. But David was born on Tencton. He came here on a student visa, which his government revoked while he was at home for the break. There's nothing to be done."
"You said you had a lot of those to do," Moose mused.
This is bigger than just Tankton, isn't it? Miss Montaigne nodded.
You are sharp, Maurice, she said. Very sharp. Yes, it's bigger. Much bigger. A dozen worlds chose to recall their people during the holidays. Undoubtedly not a coincidence. The Institute has lost... She checked her list. 52 students.
Which worlds? Tankton? Who else? Not... A chill finger of dread touched his heart. Not Zeta Cygni.
No, said Miss Montaigne with a touch of a smile. No, Zeta Cygni is hanging in. Of course, they're a former Earth colony, so their bonds are stronger, even if they have been independent for 400 years. No, it's mainly non-human worlds. Tankton, Minbar, Vulcan, New Skaro. I can't remember the rest off the top of my head, and I haven't time to look it up. The President's office will be issuing a statement to all students tonight, once everyone is back. I wouldn't be surprised if President Tiefeld addressed the student body himself.
Minbar and Vulcan. So Chenan is gone, too. And Strom. Man, Galaxy House is going to be a whole different place.
Miss Montaigne's face somehow managed to fall further, then brightened slightly as she went on. Fortunately, we do have some new students coming in as well. Two more will be joining us from Zeta Cygni, in fact. Your friend, Miss Tenjo, has persuaded one of her classmates from her former school to join us here. As a matter of fact, a young man named Miki Kaworu. And a friend of one of Caitlin's relatives is coming as well. They'll be taking David and Strom's places. I haven't been able to get everything arranged officially yet, with all these notifications to do and everything. So, if you see them before I do...
I understand, said Moose. You'd better get going. I'm sorry for taking up your time with my questions, when everything will be answered tonight.
It's all right. Miss Montaigne got to her feet and sighed. I needed the break anyway.
I don't mind if you put the new guy in with me, Moose told her. Any friend of Utena's is unlikely to get on my nerves, he added with a grin. I guess all I can do is wish you good luck with the rest of it.
She smiled wearily. Thanks. I'll need it.
He watched her move off toward the stairs up to Morgan Hall's room floors, then settled back into his previous position and thought. He was still thinking when arms encircled his bull neck from behind and a cheek pressed warmly against his own.
Hello, Azalin, he said with a smile, raising a hand to pat the bushy gray hair he knew, without looking, would be above that cheek.
"Hello yourself, Mr. Moose," Azalin Tavir Natashkin replied, releasing him to scramble over the back of the bench, hop lightly across the table, and settle herself into a lotus position opposite, facing him.
"You look worried about something," she observed without preamble.
"I am," Moose replied, "but I want to save my thoughts until we're all here."
"Fair enough," said Azalin. "I've got something I need to tell everybody, too." Seen anybody else yet?
Nope. Devlin said he wouldn't be back until this afternoon, anyway. Dunno about the others.
Oh. That's no fun. You want to play cards or something?
Sure.
They were about halfway through a game of some mutant version of Gin Rummy, involving three decks of cards, each with five suits, which Azalin had learned from a gaming contact over at Wellesley, when Amanda Dessler arrived, still decked out in a leather motorcycling costume that made her look like a cross between an international rally racer and a messenger goddess. Azalin jumped up, stepped nimbly between the stacks of cards on the table without disturbing any of them, and flung her arms around the Gamelon's neck, hugging her with her own feet completely off the floor. Amanda didn't seem particularly daunted by this. She just returned the embrace for as long as she felt proper, then brushed the Dentrovian off and shooed her back to her place before greeting Moose.
Moose, she said, rather coolly, it would have seemed to an outside observer.
Manda, Moose replied, without looking up from his hand of cards.
This rather perfunctory exchange contained, in fact, none of the distance or coldness an untrained viewer would have believed. It was just the way Moose and Amanda greeted each other after long absences.
Is Carter back yet? Amanda wondered. Not yet, said Azalin, scoring a couple of cards and making a discard. Ah, this game, Amanda noted, looking over the cards. I regret being unable to stay. There's been some mishap with my class registration for this term. I must go and see to that. I'm calling a dinner meeting for tonight, said Azalin. I've got something important to tell everybody. Amanda nodded. This shouldn't take long, she said, then turned and left.
Famous last words for reg screw-ups, Moose murmured darkly. First gin.
Bah! Azalin grumbled as Moose scored his cards, then picked up his reserve hand and sorted it. Half an hour or so after that, their game finished, Moose and Azalin were sitting, bored, watching people cross the quad through the wedge windows, when a car drove around said quad and pulled to a halt in one of the front parking spaces. It was of a type they'd never seen before, some kind of antique limousine, long and low and very black, and it had New Avalon plates.
Hey! Azalin cried as one of the car's long doors opened. That's Katie!
Caitlin Hutchins was just hauling her suitcase out of the Griffin's trunk when the wedge doors burst open and Azalin jumped down over the steps.
Katie!
The Dantrovian declared as she dashed across the narrow drive separating the wedge from the quad.
Did you have a good Christmas?
Kate smiled and dropped the case just before Azalin catapulted into her arms, almost knocking her into the trunk.
Yes, I did, she said. I had a very good Christmas.
I don't see how anyone could spend Christmas in that house and not have a good one, said Utena Tenjo as she climbed out of the passenger side. It's fun central over there. Azalin turned Kate loose and applied the same treatment to her roommate.
"So you had a good Christmas, too?" she asked.
"I sure did," Utena replied. "And a good birthday, too." She gave the Dantrovian a sly grin and nudged her with an elbow. "Kate's family really knows how to show a guest a good time."
Azalin laughed. "Now you're just making fun of me," she said with mock petulance.
"Help you with any of that stuff?" Moose inquired. "Or all of it, for that matter?"
A black-haired, black-clad boy, perhaps a year or two younger than Kate, got out of the driver's seat of a long black car, came back to the trunk, and observed, "You have got to be Moose McEachern."
"Indeed I have," said Moose expansively, "as my frame, for all its massive size, will accommodate no other man's spark. And you, sir, must be Caitlin's brother Corwin, of whom she has spoken so often and glowingly that I feel we must already be friends."
"Has she really?" Corwin asked artlessly, his cheeks going a little pink.
Anyway, yeah, that's me, Corwin Ravenhair," he added with a little bow. "At your service. Although, I'm hoping you can be at my service for a minute. I've got a piece of equipment in here that's kind of heavy."
"The big black case?" Moose asked, indicating a valise about the size of a steamer trunk in durable black polycarb.
"That's the one," said Corwin.
"I can manage that," said a slim, pale, auburn-haired girl in a subdued dark green dress and black overcoat as she emerged from the passenger seat of the limo. Without further comment or much expression, she stepped around Moose, reached into the trunk, closed her hand around the case's handle, and lifted the case out without apparent effort, for all that it was roughly her own size.
"Where shall I take it?" she asked Corwin flatly.
Into the wedge for now, but wait until the rest of us are ready."
"As you wish."
Moose raised an eyebrow. Corwin shrugged and got a couple of suitcases out of the trunk. Utena and Kate got the rest of their things, and another new person arrived from the back seat, closed the door behind him, and came back in search of luggage.
"You, sir, I don't believe I've heard of. You're not a redhead, so you must not be one of Kate's other brothers, and so I'm at a loss. Unless," Moose added with a twinkle in one green eye, "you're the famous Mr. Miki Kaworu, of whom I've lately heard so much."
The slim, blue-haired boy froze suddenly, his face taking on a look of startled puzzlement.
"Famous?" he inquired.
Moose laughed. "I'm teasing. I ran into the Dean of Student Life a bit ago, and she mentioned a new student by that name was joining us from Utena's old school. The rest was, as they say, elementary." Moose stuck out a hand. "The Honorable J. Maurice McEachern IV, your humble servant. I understand we're to be roommates."
"Oh," said Miki, shaking the proffered hand as best he could, given the way it dwarfed his own. "Well, I'm pleased to meet you, then."
"Something happened to your old one?" Utena asked. "Indeed," said Moose. "We'll talk about it in a bit."
She nodded, understanding.
"So you're a friend of Utena's from before she came here?" Azalin asked Miki.
"That's right," said Miki.
"That's cool," said Azalin. She was standing a little closer to Miki than his personal comfort zone allowed for, and gazing at him intently with her slightly unnerving molten gold eyes. As he stood looking back, growing slightly more nervous with each second, she moved closer still, until they were almost nose to nose.
"You've got really nice eyes," she told him flatly,
then stepped back with her hands folded behind her back and a big grin on her face.
"I'm Azalin. Welcome to the Institute, Miki. We're going to be great friends, you and me. I can tell just looking at you."
Said Miki. He cast about mentally for something to say to that, and finally came up with, "Well, I hope so." They went inside and piled their things around bench number one for the time being. As they were bringing them in, a wiry boy with a shock of blonde hair and a long gray coat appeared from the Daniels Hall side of things, and greeted them all with a cheery, slightly reedy, "What ho, comrades!"
"Devlin!"
said Azalin, and she repeated on him the process she'd performed on all of her returning friends so far.
"Amanda was looking for you," she told him as she released him and led him over to the booth to join the others. "She had to go to Harrington, some kind of reg problem. Said she'd be back later."
"If she's lucky," Devlin replied. "Hello! New faces! And it didn't take me 10 minutes to spot 'em this time, eh, what?"
he said with a wink for Utena.
"Devlin," said Kate, "I want you to meet Miki Kaoru, an old schoolmate of Utena's who's decided to join us here."
"Pleasure, old bean, pleasure," said Devlin, pumping Miki's outstretched hand and releasing it.
"And this is my brother Corwin?"
Course, unmistakable fellow. Couldn't be anybody else. Absolutely thrilled to make your acquaintance. What? Heard so much about you, it's like I practically know you already."
"And his friend, Dorothy Wainwright, who's also starting at the W this term."
Dorothy offered her hand rather half-heartedly. Devlin took it, but didn't pump it. Instead, he bowed, quite formally, despite the anti-formality of his flappy coat and upstanding hair, and kissed it.
"Charmed, beyond repair," said Devlin. "Carter Devlin, dear lady, or Devlin Carter. Take your pick, it don't matter."
Dorothy retrieved her hand and calmly corrected Caitlin. "I'm R. Dorothy Wainwright." There was a moment's pause, and then Devlin inquired, "The R being for the usual thing?" "Robot," Dorothy said flatly.
"Hmm," Devlin nodded. "Well, charmed all the same, what?"
"If you insist," said Dorothy.
"Have our new arrivals been assigned places to live yet?" Utena wondered.
"Well, Miki has," Moose told her. "I saw Miss Montaigne a while ago, and, well, why don't we sit down? There's a quorum, we can fill Amanda in later."
"Okay, but give me a minute," Utena said. "I'm starving. I can't wait for lunchtime."
She turned and went toward the snack bar, a miniature grill service spot commonly referred to, since it was run by the same concession company that handled the main dining halls, as Mini Deka. Mini Deka served the same food as Deka, which wasn't all that good, but it at least had the advantage of being made fresh. On the other hand, you had to pay extra for it. Right now, Utena didn't really care about that.
In fact, she customarily ate breakfast there, either through having missed the dining hall's hours, or just out of an unwillingness to suffer its rubbery, cold omelets. "Utina," said Azalin, but Utina waved the Dantrovian back without turning around. "In a minute, I'm too hungry to listen." She went into the place, which was deserted at the after-breakfast hour of 11:15 a.m., and froze for a moment in the doorway. The guy at the grill had his back turned to her, and the long, slightly wavy green ponytail trailing down his back, as well as the slim but broad-shouldered build of that back, stopped her in her tracks for a second. "Man," she thought, "the new grill guy looks just like Sionji from the back. That's going to take some getting used to." "Excuse me," she said, grabbing a plastic tray and stepping up to the stainless steel counter that bordered the grill. "Yes, may I help?" the grill guy began, turning around. Then he saw her, she saw him, and they both froze in place. The new grill guy was Kyuichi Sionji. There was a long, long, tense pause. "You," Utina finally blurted. "Well, yes, that was what I should have said next," Sionji admitted. "May I help you?"
What are you doing here?"
"Taking your order," Sionji said. "I see you weren't notified that I'm here."
No.
"Shame. I'd hoped to spare you the shock, and myself the potential injury." He put his hands on top of the sneeze guard covering the preparation counter and leaned forward a little, his eyes intent. "I know we have a lot to talk about, Tenjo, but right now I'm working. My time isn't my own. What can I get you?" Utina felt a little dizzy. She wondered if she would ever get used to having surreal things happen to her, since they seemed bent on doing so with annoying regularity.
A sausage biscuit. And a couple of those English muffin Canadian bacon things. I forget what they're called. A ham omelet. Hash browns. A large Coke."
Sionji blinked. "Do you always eat breakfast like that?"
"Usually."
He gave her a look over, then shook his head in amazement and turned his attention to the grill. Utina emerged from the snack bar with her tray a few minutes later, still looking dumbfounded.
"I tried to warn you," Azalin remarked as Utina sat down next to Kate.
"Warned her about what?"
"Oh, you remember Kyuichi Sionji?"
Kate gave her a look.
"Okay, stupid question. Anyway, I ran into him over break. Now don't get excited. He's feeling much better and would like to come back inside."
"He's working in the snack bar," Utina said to her sausage biscuit, disbelief still on her face.
"He made this."
She bit into it, chewed, swallowed.
"And it's good. Sionji's a good cook. Who the hell knew?"
"That's just a part-time thing to make some spending money," said Azalin. "He's a student." Utina nearly choked.
"Here?"
"Of course here. Where'd you think? Doherty High? He had a little trouble with the test and got knocked back a couple grades from where he says he was at the old place. But he got in. He's in our class. You'll probably have Galactic History 203 with him."
"This was the important thing you had to tell us?" Moose wondered.
"Yeah, I didn't want anybody to, you know, bug out and try to take his head off or anything before he got a chance to explain. When he gets off work, he wants to talk to you two. I imagine he's going to apologize. If he doesn't, I'm going to throttle him."
She grinned at Miki. "He'll probably be glad to see you, too. It's always good to see a face or two from back home in a new setting."
Perhaps, said Miki. "We weren't really close."
Azalin shrugged. "Well, yeah, he did mention that he used to be a real bastard. But like I said, he wants to apologize now, start over, and all that. So who knows?"
"Apologize,"
said Utina to her sausage biscuit. Then she looked over at Azalin.
What did you do to him?
Oh, you know, this and that, said Azalin offhandedly.
Talked, mostly. I find him freezing his tail off up at Bancroft Tower. Gave him dinner, talked some sense into him. The usual.
Was it a holiday? Utina asked, looking as if she didn't really want to know, but had to.
Duh, it was Christmas,
Azalin replied with exaggerated patience. Utina gave that a moment's thought, and replied with silence.
What was your news, Moose?
Caitlin asked.
Trouble, said Moose. You'll all start noticing it, and there's supposed to be an announcement tonight after everybody's back, but a bunch of governments yanked their citizens off Earth over the break. 52 students aren't coming back.
Oh, no, said Azalin. Anybody we know?
Moose nodded. Miss Montaigne didn't give me the complete list, but Davy's gone, and so are Chinan and Strom. I haven't been over to the house since I dropped off my bag, so I don't know who else, but... He spread his hands. Looks bad.
Why'd they do it, I wonder? Azalin mused.
The extension to the Psionics Regulation and Protection Act is before the Earthdome Assembly again, Devlin pointed out, his tone graver than usual. And it looks like it has a good chance of passing this time, what? Off-Earth conscription powers for the Psi-Corps, expansion of their jurisdiction from the homeworld to the borders of the whole Alliance, all that rot. High Psionic potential races are nervous, and well they should be. They're backing away from Earth as a gesture of protest.
He shook his head. Won't work. Internal operations of a sovereign nation and all that. Won't be too long before they're pushing a similar extension for the whole Federation. And if the outer races back off instead of fighting, well, peace in our time, as they say.
You know a lot about it, said Azalin, sounding surprised. Big news back in the old country, Devlin replied offhandedly. Most of the country's top physicists suddenly leaving will have a tendency to make the papers. More Vulcans in Britain than any place else on Earth, until last week, you know.
Nodded Azalin. Corwin glanced at his watch.
I don't want to be a pain, he said, but I've got to get back to New Avalon before the middle of the night this time.
Right, well, let's get everything squared away, said Utina, and we'll meet back here for lunch.
WPI's campus is bordered to the south by a line of 8 pleasant, tree-lined side streets which lead down the side of Institute Hill, perpendicular to Institute Road, 5 of them lying to the west of West Street, which bisects the campus along the north-south line, the other 2 east of it. These streets make up a quiet residential neighborhood, which is a nice 1-block-deep buffer zone between WPI and the relative bustle of Highland Street's commercial strip. Several of the old-fashioned wood-frame houses on these streets belong to the Institute and are used as student residences. They fall under the same aegis and basic guidelines as the dormitories and the on-campus Ellsworth and Fuller apartments, which are located just across Institute Road from the 3 main dormitories, Morgan, Daniels, and Sanford Riley Halls, but are a bit further from school, a bit quieter and smaller, providing a semi-off-campus living experience for the lucky students to be assigned to them, while remaining close enough to campus to prevent that sense of disconnection so common to off-campus living. One of these, the 2-story yellow affair at 22 Schussler Road, is known by the school's administration as Galaxy House. Galaxy House is part of the Worcester Preparatory Institute's much-publicized Commitment to Diversity. The criteria for being assigned as one of its 7 residents are simple. One must be other than a first-year student, and not from Earth, nor an Earth colony independent for less than 2 centuries. Moose McEachern was such a student, and had lived in Galaxy House since the start of this school year. It was here that he led Miki, Corwin, and Dorothy, the last of whom still carried that enormous case without apparent difficulty. Someone from residential life had been along to stick post-it notes on the doors of the upstairs bedrooms, denoting the revised living assignments. It was with a glum expression that Moose found one of the double rooms now completely vacant.
He already knew, of course, but seeing it that way, in black and white, well, black and yellow, somehow made it harder to take. He sighed. "Well, this is the place," he said. "Man, gonna be quiet around here without Beld and Jacron."
"Jacron hasn't gone anywhere," a disgruntled voice remarked from behind them, and a burly Narn, well, perhaps not in comparison to Moose, but against Miki and Corwin, burly,
shouldered past, yanked the post-it off the door of room 22S/2, and crumpled it. Miki, who had never knowingly seen a non-human before, he hadn't noticed that Azalin was one, tried not to stare. Jacron was humanoid in general arrangement, with the appropriate numbers of limbs, digits, and sensory organs in the correct configuration, but there the resemblance ended. He was tall, though not as tall as Moose, and broad, though not as broad as Moose. His skin was mottled in different shades of brown and hairless. His head was bald and vaguely wedge-shaped, with deep hollows around his eyes, which were a red so bright they almost seemed to glow. He had a very pointed chin. It was a face which was well suited to indignant scowling, which was just what it was doing now. There was something odd, thought Miki, about seeing such a creature dressed in blue jeans, hiking sandals, and a t-shirt emblazoned with incomprehensible alien script.
"Narn's not pulling out?" Moose asked.
"This Narn isn't," Jacron replied, almost sputtering with annoyance. "To suggest that my education be interrupted because of some internal political wrangling to do with this human organization, which has nothing to do with us, this is an outrage."
"Mm-hmm," said Moose, who was apparently accustomed to his housemate's bursts of temper.
"Jacron, I'd like you to meet a couple of incoming students in the middle of all this mess. This is Miki Kaworu, who's going to be rooming with me, and Dorothy Wainwright. And this is Kate Hutchins' brother Corwin. He's helping Dorothy get settled in."
"I'm very pleased to meet all of you," said Jacron, who didn't really sound it, but was so caught between seeming harried and blustering that he didn't sound sarcastic about it either. "If you'll excuse me, I have to write a letter to the Narn Consulate while the vitriol is still fresh, telling them what I think of this."
He pulled a piece of paper from his pocket, unfolded it, and refreshed his memory.
"Purely voluntary, but strongly suggested withdrawal from an area of crisis. Bah!"
Crumpling that paper, too, he turned on his heel and stalked into his room, slamming the door behind him.
"Well, that was Jacron," said Moose. "Don't worry, you'll get used to him. He caps off like that about once a week about something or other, but he's mostly harmless."
He shook his head.
"Anyway..."
He led the way down the hall to the door at the end, which had, over its 22S/4 plate, a post-it reading, "Wainwright, R. Dorothy." This door he opened, swung wide, and stood aside from, allowing Dorothy to pass him and plunk the giant case she carried down next to the bed. The room wasn't all that big. Big enough for the bed, a dresser, and enough floor space not to seem claustrophobic, until she put that case down and took up most of it. It had a dormered window, a couple of odd slants to the ceiling because of the house's double gambrel roof, and a closet, and the walls were painted in a pleasantly neutral shade. Dorothy stood where she'd stopped, put down the case, and looked around, as ever seeming somewhat disinterested.
"So," Moose wondered from the doorway, "what's in the case?"
"It's a portable maintenance bay for Dorothy," said Corwin as he put her suitcases on the bed. "Should take care of all her basic needs, day-to-day adjustments, lubrication, minor repairs, that kind of thing. Kate told me you're an engineering student?"
"That's right. Mostly amplification and the like, but I have a little robotics."
"Good enough. Miki, can you give him the checkout run on the box sometime soon? It'd be nice if there were more than one person around who can run it in case something happens."
"I'll do that," said Miki, nodding.
"Well, Dorothy... what do you think?" asked Corwin, looking around.
"I won't need the bed," said Dorothy.
"You should keep it anyway," Corwin advised her. "They're handy to have around sometimes."
Dorothy looked the institution-issue wood-framed rack over from one end to the other,
turned to him and deadpanned, "I doubt it would support me, let alone me and someone else." Corwin went bright red. Behind him, so did Miki, who then timed something. "That's not what I meant," he replied. "Where'd you get an idea like that?"
"Usenet," said Dorothy.
"Stop reading alt groups," said Corwin, annoyed.